Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
Gail McMeekin with us, the founder and president of Creative Success, LLC, and the author of The 12 Secrets of Highly Creative Women and The Power of Positive Choices. Work's been featured in Redbook, the Boston Globe, Health, Investors, Business Daily, and other national publications. She's a frequent guest on radio and TV. She holds an MSW from Boston University and a certificate in human resource management from Bentley College, and completed the coursework for the Coaches Training Institute. And let us say, Gail, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Gail, let me ask you this. Most people are creative within, that's that innovative something that everybody carries. But in all of your experience in working with even men, women, it really doesn't matter, the human being, what is that something, that challenge that they have to get over? What holds them back usually?
It's usually fear of being wrong or making a mistake.
Now, is the fear comes from their own experience, or is it the fear of what they've been taught by someone else? Do they have a tough time making that transition of their choice as opposed to somebody else's choice of how they are?
Yes. If you think about how we are when we're little kids and we play at the beach or in the sandbox or build something with blocks, early on, we're not worried about how people are evaluating what we're doing. We're just having fun and putting different combinations together and creating something. But as we get older and we start to get feedback or judgments or critique, almost everybody can go back and remember an experience where they got shamed somehow or embarrassed for. They're just expressing their opinion or trying something new or painting a tree purple in kindergarten. It doesn't really matter what it is. So, and also, some organizations don't make it safe for people to make mistakes. There's too much pressure to be perfect. They're not encouraging an innovative environment.
Now, would it be also that, you know, a tremendous amount of women in that creative, that competitive job market, especially in today's job market, is there that fear holding them back of, because they're a woman, they're not going to be accepted? You know, there's that mindset that has been running around for years and years and years. Is this one of the problems that a lot of women have in going out and challenging whatever that is that they're coming up against?
One of the things that's slightly different from men and women, and a lot of these things apply to men as well, is women are very frightened of rupturing their relationships, whether it's with their family, their children, in a work environment. So when they get into a situation where they need to push through some resistance, they have to begin to feel comfortable doing that, and they also have to be willing to get criticized, because when we put ourselves out there and we have a leadership position or we write a book or whatever, there are going to be people out there who don't get it and are critical. And we need to learn how to get slammed, get up, and keep moving.
Now, and by the way, one of the things that I've learned from years and years and years of listening to criticism, you know, you're a talk show host, believe me, it's out there no matter what you do. And one of the things I've learned to really get over it, and when you know you've passed it all by, I will use this kind of language. If somebody walks up to you and says, you know, you're a real butthead with what you do, and if your comment back to them is, yes, I'm very good at it, that I think is the power that says they can't affect you anymore, because so many people are so frightened to death of criticism. And the problem, Gail, with that, it's somebody else's opinion. Then most of the time it's got nothing to do with you. It's all about them and how they would respond to something.
Absolutely. And sometimes people just Well, there's some people out there, particularly people that go on Amazon, for example, and they I don't know what they're doing all day, but they just spend all day criticizing books that, that looks like they've never read. And I think when we feel passionate, like you do, about what we're doing, and we know we're serving a purpose and we're on a mission and so forth, it's easier to say that we're not going to be a member of the 100% club.
Yeah.
Where everybody agrees with us all the time. And sometimes people make valid criticisms that, that's worth listening to. And I talk about this in my books, really looking at your source, because sometimes we need to hear some feedback so we can improve. And that's okay. But we need to sort out.
Is there a isn't there a distinction between constructive criticism and somebody just telling you how bad you are?
Oh, totally, totally. I always tell people when they're starting a business or doing a creative project or expressing themselves in whatever way, inventing a new product, that they need to really sort out who are the people that might just be envious or jealous or criticize everything, and who are the people that you trust enough to give you good constructive criticism. And I also tell people to find a trusted devil's advocate, somebody who thinks differently, perhaps a left brain person if you're right brain,
sure,
who is going to ask you questions that you may not have thought of, just to help you be prepared for anything that might come up. And also, there may be an angle that you're totally missing, but they have to be respectful and trustworthy people, not just some random fan who just wants to throw a dart at you.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe when it really comes down to it, when it really comes down to it, it's all about how you feel about yourself. I learned a very valuable lesson 20, 25 years ago. I was doing a workshop, and I jumped up on the chair, and I looked at the audience, and I said, describe me. And I got everything from you loving, wonderful, nurturing individual to you self-centered, egotistical son of a yada, 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 right? And I said, who are you talking about? And they said, you. And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. See, they were projecting. It had nothing to do with me. It had to do with maybe the way I look, the way I talk, the sound of my voice, my gender, my ethnicity, my something, whatever the case may be, whatever it was. And I realized that it wasn't about me. And I think most people, when they get some kind of criticism, they begin to realize it's not about you. It's about the person who's giving it to you, and it's about something in their own life. And when we start to get that, all of a sudden the world turns around for us. You're not going to please everybody, but those people who need to hear what you have to say, go for it. Run through the challenges, run through the roadblocks, hurdle those fences, and take whatever flack you're going to get, because somebody's life may change because of what you had to say.
Exactly. And this fantasy that we're going to be liked all the time, that we're going to do things perfectly all the time, that we have to have it all together every minute, we can't be a vulnerable human being. We need to let all that go and recognize that we have certain strengths and certain weaknesses, and we need to play our strengths and figure out how to delegate and have other people deal with things that we're not so good at.
You know, I have the most important person in the world who likes me that's on my side. And realistically, everybody's got the same person. It's me. Because if I like me, I don't care about what anybody else says. That doesn't mean that that you're egotistical or you're there's anything wrong with you. But you know what, Gail? If I can't like me, how am I going to like you? And so realistically, when you look in the mirror, you got to like what you see. And then you can go out and take whatever garbage there is out there and turn it into some really great stuff.
That's true. But for a lot of women, we grew up learning how to defer to other people and be nice all the time and take care of other people first and put ourselves last. There's been a lot of self-sacrificing and holding back and getting along. And I mean, Oprah talks about the people-pleasing disease and how you have to get over that. So for a lot of women, and certainly men too, who've had some of the same conditioning, we have to go through a process where we have a chapter in my new book called Heal Your Self-Esteem and Your Fears, because as you're saying, you need to work it through and let go of it so you're less afraid.
No, absolutely. And I realistically believe that if you sat down and you began to define is the word I'm looking for. If you began to define what your fear is, because most people work on a problem that they do not have as opposed to the ones that they do have, and you never get anywhere. So in essence, if you can find out what that fear is, it might even surprise you many times.
Oh, sure. I mean, we know the most common fear is fear of public speaking, according to all the research. But I know from having trained people to be speakers that some people love a huge audience and other people that terrifies them, and other people are petrified to be in a small, intimate group. And for a lot of people who are introverts, that's really comfortable. Some people do better in a casual environment. Some people do better in a corporate environment. We're in the sphere of fear. There, we all have our own individual take on it. So we really do have to dissect it and figure out, now, what is that that's really got me petrified, and how am I going to fix it?
Now, one of the things that got me petrified right now is we're running out of time, and I would love to talk to you all night long. Let me ask this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's creativesuccess.com. And I actually, if people go there, I have a free ebook called The Path to Creative Success, which is loaded with all kinds of exercises on procrastination and fear and visualization and some of the things that we've talked about tonight. And you can just download that.
Great. Hey, Gail, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciated it. And there's so many people that are, quote unquote, suffering from what you've got the solution to, that they need to listen and get your book.
Thank you, Michael, so much. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Good night.
Okay, good night.
Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michelle Rickman's with us, co-author of 101 Great Ways to Enhance Your Career. Hey, Michelle, welcome back.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good. How are you? Are you having fun?
I'm always having fun.
Oh, this is good. Are you looking forward to the big day Thursday?
Thanksgiving. Well, not looking forward to the calories.
But at least have fun while you're doing it. Now, by the way, obviously we know there are holidays. And there's a lot of people that are starting to get a little nervous, get a little edgy, because when the holidays are over between now and Christmas, they have to go look for a job. They have to go reestablish themselves out in the work world or reinvigorate the career that they're in now. Too many people are out there, and it seems as though with all the different interviews, the one overarching theme seems to be fear. People are frightened to death to go out and show their best self to somebody that they want a job with. And I think they're afraid of this word sell. They're afraid that they have to sell themselves to someone. And when you really come down to it, Michelle, if you don't know how to do it, you're not going to get the job.
Absolutely. When you're going in for an interview, you have to remember that you are a walking salesman for yourself. And again, you're a product, and you need to put your best foot forward and really market yourself from the moment you walk in the door, actually from the moment you walk in the building.
And by the way, when we talk about sell yourself, how much of it is you that you're selling, or what you have to offer is what you're selling?
It's really more about what you have to offer. So when you're going in for an interview, it's really, really important to have a good understanding of the company, of the position or the potential positions that you could be interviewing for, and to know what value you can bring to the table, so that's what you're putting up front when you are showcasing yourself.
Now, there are so many people who are not necessarily afraid of doing that. I think, Michelle, the problem is they don't know to do that. I have felt for a long time, you know, in the old days when you talked about if you were going to sell something, they had to like you, they had to trust you, and they had to do all of these things. I won't say always, for many years, I've totally disagreed with that. It's not liking you, trusting you. It's what you represent that they've got to like, they've got to trust, that they know that they're going to get some kind of benefit out of it. And that for the most part, it's a degree of presentation that most people don't even know exists.
Yeah, I mean, you always have to go back and think of it as a product. You know, vitamins, you don't have to like them, but what value do they bring as far as when you're marketing them to a consumer? You're not necessarily saying that they taste good, but you are saying here's the value that they offer for your health, you know, just as an example. And therefore, that's what sells them.
No, absolutely. And there's a T-shirt that I have around here, and nobody pays attention to it, but one of these days they'll hear it. I keep telling them, pamper the product, and it doesn't work. No good. But when you really come down to it, you are a product when you do this. And there is a language to speak to those people that you're making the offer to. And if you don't speak their language, you're not going to get them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, somebody comes in and they say, okay, I want to apply for a job, a position, or something. What's the first thing? What's the first step you take them through?
When a person comes,
when they come to
for
you.
Preparation,
when they're looking to get a job, start a new career, enhance what they've already got. What do you take them through? What do you look at first?
Well, generally, if a person is looking to kind of enhance what's already existing, I really take them through exercises of trying to get everything out of them that they've accomplished. So I'm not as interested in the tasks as far as here's what I did, but really here's what I've achieved. So the formula that I use when I go through working with my clients is tell me about the challenges. Tell me in each position that you have been in, what were you challenged to do? And then once we have that, then we go in through another level. What were you challenged to do? And then what did you do? And how did you do it? And then finally, after we know what you did and how you did it, what was the positive end result, and how did that impact your employer? And when you put those three things together, the challenge, the action, and the result, now you have a content-rich story to sell yourself and to sell what value you have to offer to a new employer.
Okay, and that makes sense. And realistically, I'll give you a prime example of this. Years and years and years ago, I was a sales manager at a radio station. And what we would do is we would hire new salespeople in. And I had an idea one day. I got creative with it. We put an ad in the paper, and we got 15, 20 people who came in and applied. And I thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to break it down. I'm going to take it over a week's period of time. And as I took everybody through the training, that if I saw that they were going to make it, then we'd step outside and I'd say thank you, and they knew, and it was okay, and it worked that way. But the very first question that I asked when everybody came in, and I said, what's a salesman? What's a salesperson? And Michelle, you wouldn't believe the answers I was getting. Okay, and they were applying for a job to do that. This word selling is so frightening to most people, and it works this way. Selling, if you define it, is offer and acceptance. You make an offer, somebody accepts it, somebody rejects it. Somebody falls in love with somebody, and the guy says, will you marry me? Now, he's made an offer. Now, the woman can either accept or reject. If she says yes, she's been sold. All right. It's that simple, and I really believe it's a mindset, and you got to get your head out of that mindset of what you think it is, because you're not selling a $100 used car that's not going to work and you've cheated somebody. That is not selling. And I believe in my heart of hearts, you got to get that down, that you got to go sell yourself.
Yeah, I'd say one of the most difficult things that I encounter when I'm working with my clients is that they really don't understand that this is a place, whether it's your resume, your interview, your job search, the calls that you're making, the networking that you're doing, you need to be bragging appropriately. You really need to be saying, here's what I've got and here's why it's great. And I do recommend when people are in job search mode that they put together a brag book. And that is what it's called. It's a book of accomplishments, of clips, of anything that a person has done in their career that's really noteworthy, publications that they've written, accolades, letters that they've received, surveys, client surveys that have been well received. Putting together something that's solid that they can organize and walk into an interview with, if somebody would like to see that kind of portrayal of their career.
Oh, no question. And it's almost like setting up a script to a movie. They've got to experience, they've got to see it, they've got to feel it, and they actually have to become part of it. The becoming part of it is that part when they're sitting there looking at you and they're seeing themselves inside your story. But they're the person, they're the character in that story that's going to benefit what you have to offer. And you and I, we've touched on this before, but when it comes down to it, it's the job that you're applying for may not be the job that they have that they'll offer you, because there could be something even better. So you got to be open enough to not be stuck in one particular direction to go.
Yes, absolutely.
And hopefully I never have to get your services. Now, by the way, I know you've been doing it for a long time. When you first started doing this, was there a difference in the mindset of getting a job than there is today? What's different today that, I mean, we know what the economy is like and we know what the job market's like, but what's different today that we have to make sure that we address in our presentation to that prospective employer?
Well, one of the biggest differences today is really the use of social media. So people that are interviewing you really have quite a bit of information on you before you ever walk in the door. So you're not walking in sight unseen. Years ago, when you came in on an interview, the person only had perhaps preconceived notions of what you looked like and what your background might be. But people really can do their homework on candidates that are coming in for interviews. So things are a lot more transparent than they were years ago. And it's really important, therefore, to really, you know, make sure that you're protecting your identity and protecting your online identity and making sure that that's a positive thing and making sure that everything that you're doing is really in alignment with everything else. So your profile matches your resume. You can't really hide and say, well, I didn't work here or cover things up or because it's so easy to find that information. You really absolutely must be honest about everything that you're doing in your job search because employers really do their homework and are able to find out quite a bit of information before you ever walk in the door.
So, by the way, knowing that they know, what either is going to make somebody comfortable or uncomfortable. But let's say that you had it all together, you got a good background, you're going to be comfortable with what you got. You play on that, don't you? You play on what you know they know. And I think that in and of itself is critical.
Yeah. You're walking in, obviously, you want to play what they already know, but then you want to come in with some tricks in your back pocket of what they don't know that you're going to wow them with. So it's important not only to make sure that your profile and your information is accessible and people can find it, but it is important to come to be able to show them something new when you walk in the door so that you do have that element of surprise or that element of, you know, wow, I really have to have this person because they've already, you know, kind of determined what their thoughts are about you sometimes before you walk in the door.
Interesting point. So you either have to build who you are or at least give them enough information so you maintain the image.
Correct.
Fun stuff. I don't want to apply for a job. It's getting anymore. Yeah, and I think really when it comes down to it, somebody just going out for a job today, you might as well. I think that's one of the reasons there's such a high unemployment rate because it's not just walking in and applying for a job. There is a structure. There is a step by step element to doing so. And if you don't have that down, somebody who does, who could be even lesser than you are as far as being the right person for that job, could get that job.
Yes, because it's all about strategy, and it's competitive, and really the people that are getting the jobs and the people that are getting in the door are the people that are planning and really being strategic about their search. So the people that are not prepared and are kind of going back to the same old from 15, 20 years ago where they're just looking in the where we used to look in the papers, but looking online, looking at the boards, but not getting up close and personal and finding the right decision makers and really appealing to specific people within companies to say, here's what's in my background, here's how I think it's a fit. Those are the people that are not really getting what they're looking for.
Well, there's another question that comes up, which I think, well, we're starting to run out of time now, but to address it in this way, do most people know what they're looking for? And I think that is a very fair question to ask most people. If they come in, they're going to apply for a job. Do you know what you're looking for? And it would be very interesting to hear, 20 or 30 different answers.
Yes, it's a very good question. There are certainly lots of different ways, career assessments and things along those lines that we can do that will help people kind of steer them towards things that they would be good at or things that might be of interest to them. But it's very important to be realistic. So while a person may think that they know what they want, we need to evaluate whether or not what they want is really a realistic and viable option.
Oh, no question about it. Let me ask you this. We're just about running out of time. Website we can find you at?
I am at ricklandresources.com, and that's R-I-K-L-A-N, resources.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michelle, see you next week.
See you next week. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're away. Got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Peter Spinagati coming up right after this.
I hope you feel lonely.
Peter Spinagati is the author of Explaining Unhappiness, Dissolving the Paradox. He's a native of New York City. He was the founding director of the Riverdale Consultation Center, offices in Riverdale in Manhattan, and for 30 years a psychotherapist and a marriage counselor, and holds a master's degree from City University, University of New York, and also has been a college instructor, a corporate consultant, appeared on various talk shows, radio, TV, and both a participant and an advisor on cultural and mental health matters. Peter, hi, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. With all of your experience, you know, explaining unhappiness, we all have this drive to find happiness in our lives. Does anybody even know what it is? And is there really a definition of happiness that most people can wrap their arms around?
That's a terrific question. Well, let me just tell you my background so I can tell you how what instigated my writing this book. Now, sure. You may have noticed in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been literally thousands of books on how to be happy, and none that I was aware of that explicitly dealt with the question of unhappiness, the very problem that these books are designed to remediate. And so it seemed to me it was very much like a doctor writing prescriptions for an ailment that hasn't been sufficiently diagnosed. So it occurred to me that I wanted to fill this void. But more important, as I was a practicing psychotherapist for 30 years, it occurred to me that regardless of the presenting complaint that people came to see me in my office, I noticed there seemed to be a sort of sameness about their complaint. And so I was questioning whether or not there was a psychological common denominator, a sine qua non, some sort of indispensable condition or that without which you couldn't experience unhappiness. And happily, after a number of years of thinking about this subject, I discovered that there was. That became the instigating question for the whole book that I wrote.
Now, by the way, when we get into the it was, I think in and of itself, Peter, that's the major problem that I would guess. There's no statistic for this, but 90% of the population of the planet has no idea what happiness is, and in and of itself can be a myth. A myth that started out with somebody saying, well, this is it. Happiness is the new car. Happiness is the relationship. Happiness is the, and then, you know, the list goes on and on and on.
Yes.
And the big problem would be from my, and I'm not a clinician, but from my eyes, would be they're looking for happiness outside as opposed to what sits inside.
That's a very penetrating question, and you're right on the money. you're quite right. In other words, what happens if you look at these books, they tell you about, well, you know, what is the relationship between happiness and more money and a bigger house? And I'm not denying the pleasurable responses to these kinds of things, but it has nothing to do with unhappiness. Unhappiness is a state of mind, and I'm going to define it for a moment for you. Unhappiness is a state of mind which is portable, and regardless of the circumstances in which you find yourself, that's not going to change unless you change what's inside your head. It's a psychological problem which requires a psychological solution, not a material solution. So let's define unhappiness, right? And I'll run it by you, and you tell me if it fits your experience. Now, when somebody says they're unhappy, what are they saying? They're saying they're feeling bad. And if you ask them, well, what does feeling bad mean? It means feeling in a way you don't want to feel. I don't think anybody would quarrel with that definition. I think it would be a perversion of language and experience to say that that's not the case, right? So then what is it that people do in their heads that they carry around, regardless of the circumstances in which they find themselves, that makes them unhappy? I think that would be the pertinent question. Would you agree, Michael?
I'm right with you.
Okay.
Yes.
So let me give you some examples. Let me make some concrete examples of how this happens. Now, over the years, I've dealt with a lot of people, all kinds of. In 30 years, you can imagine what I've heard. Is there anything I haven't heard? But one, let's say, take a negative emotion, which is equivalent to being unhappy. Let's say an emotion like jealousy. I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that jealousy is a very unhappy state of mind. Now, when you deal with an unhappy person, they really don't have a clue as to why they're unhappy. They may have some suggestions here and there, but they really don't know. Now, typically, here's what happens. Let's say a woman goes to a party, and during the course of a party, her husband ends up talking to this attractive woman. Now, she observes this, and she decides to compare herself to this woman. Now, jealous people never compare themselves to people who they regard as their inferior. They always compare themselves to somebody who they get as their superior. So jealousy is that's how they do it. Now, I'm offering this as a non-specific, a non-cultural, and a non-gender statement. Anybody who's jealous, I'm going to be presumptuous enough to say what goes on in their head. What they do is they compare themselves to somebody that they regard as their superior. It would be a contradiction. They never compare themselves to somebody who's their superior, their inferior. And so she focuses on the woman, and she decides that this woman is more vivacious, more attractive, more sexy, whatever. Now, that's not a problem yet, but she does one more thing. She decides to feel bad having made the comparison. And that's how jealousy comes about. Now, her understanding of jealousy would be something like this. Well, had her husband not been talking to this attractive woman, she would not have gotten jealous. But that's a rather simplistic idea as to how jealousy occurs. Jealousy occurred before she even went to the party, because what made her unhappy was her belief that she was less than desirable, less than adequate. And that predisposed her to look at this woman talking to her husband. Now, in her mind, she would be thinking that, well, she caused her to be jealous. In point of fact, she merely triggered what was already in her head. So she looks at this woman, and she sees this woman as more attractive, and she starts to become jealous. Now, with that same mindset, she can do something else, and she can focus on another feature of the environment. She can look, for example, at her husband and then start to feel resentment. And then she can look at, for example, what other people may be thinking, and then she can start feeling humiliation. Now, you notice three separate nameable emotions: jealousy, resentment, and humiliation, all presumably with different causes, but they could not occur had she not been thinking that there was something about her that was less than desirable.
Okay, Peter,
denominator I'm aiming at here, Michael.
Yeah, let's add something to this, okay? I'm listening very closely to you. And again, I'm not a clinician. Unhappiness, okay? And if you wanted to define it, it would define it as not getting what you want. Now, let's add something to that. Somewhere there's a thought that says you don't deserve to get it. We're saying the same thing, saying it a different way. You don't deserve to get it. So no matter what happens, what you get presented with, what you get offered, what you have in your hands, somewhere, if you've got that thought in your head that you don't deserve it, you're going to end up being unhappy. You will drive it out of your life. You won't appreciate it. You're going to do something. And it is a mindset. And you said it, and I think that's the core of all the problems that we have with the battles back and forth and relationships and so on and so forth. Has got nothing to do with the other person. Has got nothing to do with the environment. It has to do with what you're holding inside. And then you see something familiar that triggers that something, and then the stuff starts, and it has nothing to do with the situation at the moment.
That's absolutely accurate, but let me reformulate it, maybe give you another dimension to this thing.
Sure.
You see, if you believe, like, let's take people not getting what you want. Now, theoretically, that would say, well, people don't get what they want, that makes them unhappy. But that's not necessarily accurate. For example, I have had clients, I've been getting one client, they win the lottery, presumably something they would really want, and they have all kinds of problems. But the question is this, really. You see, when a person wants something and they get unhappy when they don't, when they don't get it, it's not simply the fact that they're not getting it, because you and I have both observed people who could be very gracious. There are people like who are sore losers, and people who are not sore losers. They lose graciously. Here's what the difference is. The person who gets unhappy when they don't get what they want has a stake, has an ego stake in the outcome. In other words, when they don't get what they want, they're using that as evidence that there's something about them that makes them a loser, which they already believed about themselves before they even got involved in the episode. You see what I'm getting at? In other words, how is it possible that some people get very unhappy when they don't get what they want and other people don't? Well, the people who do get unhappy have, as I say, has an ego stake. There was somehow they believe it says something about them. They condemn themselves for not being able to get what they want, which confirms the point I made earlier. They come to the table, to the psychological table, with an idea about themselves that there's something about them that's not quite right. Anybody who's at peace with themselves would not put themselves down, condemn themselves, get unhappy when things don't go their way.
Okay, let's add something to it, another dimension. And I love the way you phrased it, because it's true. So you see something, you recognize it, it's familiar, it's evidence, all right. But you see, winning the lottery, if you don't deserve it, is not getting what you want. You needed to lose. You needed not to get it so you could feel bad about it. That's the value, and that's the prize at the end of the night. So we always get what we let me take it back. We may not get what we need, but we always get what we want. And what we want comes from whatever that thought about ourselves that we have is.
Yes, I would add this. You see, when we want something, a psychological need is really an invention. Because if you look at the word need in a psychological context, it always means need to be happy. But that's not necessarily the case. A biological need is something which is biologically driven. If you don't get it, biological need means you without it, you die. But a psychological need is an invention, which is to say, if I don't get what I want, well, if I don't get what I need, well, what does that mean? It means that, well, I can't be happy without it. But that's something you invented.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really believe there's a major difference between the word, and people get confused, between the word need and the word want. Marketers for years always developed their programs around a needs analysis. It doesn't work. It's a wants analysis. You know, you've got a contractor who, you know, you need your roof fixed. Okay, fine. You don't need your roof fixed. You don't want it to be leaking on you. And that's the reason you got the roof fixed. And I really believe if people would make that transition to the difference between need and want and really get down to what do you want. And what they want is one thing and one thing only, is to prove themselves right about themselves. And that goes both ways. If I'm in a great space, I'm going to prove myself right about me being in a great space. If I'm not, I'll find the evidence to prove I'm not.
Yes, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sure.
So wanting is perfectly legitimate. But whenever you convert a want into a need, you've just done yourself a disservice. I mean, I could talk more about that, but I don't want to spend too much time on the subject. But in the end, to say that a psychological need is an invention is quite controversial, because it really is. Because you and I have both observed that people pursue things, and there are some people who lose graciously and some people who don't. Well, what allows that to happen? According to my analysis, it means, for example, that a person who loses graciously is a person who is not using that to determine who they are. They already know who they are.
And they haven't lost.
Right. They haven't got one they want, but it doesn't say anything about them, because they accept the rules of the game. They say, well, in any kind of enterprise, things may not turn out. But they're not going to use that as evidence for why there's something wrong with them. See, the point I'm making, Michael, is it's a very important question that I'm saying, and this is quite, I think, quite radical, that all our unhappiness is the result of our predisposition to believe that there's something wrong with us. If we remove that from the equation, we're at peace with ourselves. And so the events of the world would take place. It's not that we don't want these events are not going to happen, but we're not going to use them as evidence that there's something about us that we have to correct, which means we don't go through life in a chronic state of self-apology. Now, if you would ask me, what does unhappiness mean? Well, I think I can give you a rather definitive answer. Unhappiness is a state of chronic self-doubt. When that doubt has been removed from our reflections, we are, whatever you might want to call that, a state of peace.
Okay, and it comes from, and this is one of your talking points, which is so true, very spot on, is the power of beliefs.
Oh,
we hope,
yes,
we get.
So now, if you look at belief, I mean, you know, belief is really the bedrock of human consciousness. I mean, everything we do comes from what we believe to be the case. I mean, for example, I'm talking to you sitting down in the belief that the chair is supporting my weight. You're talking to me in the belief that somehow we may have an interesting program, and it goes on incessantly. So what we believe determines what we do, and it determines what we feel. So then the question is, well, how do we get to believe what we believe? Well, I'm saying that it's freely chosen.
Yeah.
And that's important. So I spent some time, various chapters of my book, showing that genetics and biochemistry and the environment do not cause us to believe that there's something about us that's wrong. I mean, there is a connection, but not what most people think. So if it's true that we believe that there's something about us that's not quite right, that we're less than desirable, like the jealous lady, then the next question would have to be, well, why do we choose such a belief? We're free not to believe it, right?
True. No, by
so
the way,
why do we choose it? Now, here's where it gets pretty hairy, Michael. I don't want to get overly intellectual about this, but this is what's really interesting. You notice the subtitle of my book is The Dissolving of a Paradox. Well,
yes.
The reason why people believe that they're bad, I mean, if you were to ask anybody, why do you believe you're bad? Why do you believe there's something about you that's wrong? And I think you and I would both agree that virtually everybody on planet Earth to some degree believes that. You know? So I would ask the question, okay, why do you freely choose to believe that there's something wrong with you? Why do you freely choose to believe that you're bad? Now, I've asked this question of a lot of people, and I don't think I've ever heard an answer. But after I tell them that, they say, oh, yes, it has to be that. So let me ask you, I'll give you a puzzle, Michael. Why do you think people freely choose to believe that they're bad?
Say that one more time.
Why do you think people freely choose to believe that they're bad? It's quite an extraordinary thing.
Let me
it's
give you
so
the answer.
I never heard anybody tell me the right answer.
The answer to that,
that
is simple,
bad.
Because somebody told them that they were.
Yes, but why do they believe it? But you know there's no obligation to believe what people tell you, right?
Wait, but yeah, well, no, absolutely. No, we have to believe what they tell us. Who are we not to believe that we're bad? You see, that's
the
whole point.
Well, we would be bad for not believing what they tell us. But why do we do that? There were some people who figured it out, I'm quite sure. You know, some kids have caught on. But yeah, of course, we're all taught, whether in a religious or a secular context, that we're bad. Right? We're taught that. But the interesting question is, well, wait a minute, I know we were taught it. But the question is, why did we learn it? Because people can't force us to learn. They may teach, but it's up to us to learn it, right?
Sure.
If teaching guaranteed, for example, success, every school system in the world would be successful. So teachers teach, but students learn. So if we learn something, I'm suggesting that we learn it because it has redeeming value. Otherwise, we wouldn't have learned it in the first place.
Peter,
but
Weber,
you and
let
I were
up,
both taught all manner of things when we were kids, and you don't believe everything you were taught, do you?
Okay, wait, let me hold you up because we're starting to run out of time. But in the 150 years I've been a broadcaster, I've learned this. And a human being longer than that on this planet, I've come to a point in my life where I don't believe anything. I didn't even believe this would be a good show. Let me tell you what we did. When we started the show, we created it to be a good show.
Yes.
You hear it? Yeah, that's really what it's all about. Now, by the way, we're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. DissolvingUnhappiness.com or ExplainingUnhappiness.com.
Okay, wonderful. And by the way, can we get the book there?
Yeah, we can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Explaining Unhappiness, Dissolving the Paradox.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Michael, thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night, Peter.
Good night.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. Gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yes, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a wanna be. It's some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. For you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Gazzaniga is with us. He's the author of Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. He's one of the foremost thinkers of our time. He's a professor of psychology and the director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and oversees an extensive and broad research program investigating how the brain, let me say it, the brain enables the mind, as well as the Summer Institute in Cognitive Neuroscience at Dartmouth, which awarded him an honorary degree in 2011 commencement. And let us say, Michael, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Michael, the mind, you know, our brain is an electrochemical factory, obviously, and everything we do has a chemical component about it, the information we take in, the output, et cetera, et cetera. How critical is it for us to have a base understanding of how this all works in allowing us to live a decent, normal life?
Well, I think it's part of the modern times to be asking the question, how do certain things work? And in the last 60, 70 years, there's been an explosion of information to figure out how the brain works and how it does the things that allow us to be talking here tonight, and it allows us to appreciate the world around us and basically try to come to a biologic understanding of what makes us tick. And I think to understand that will help us understand the variations that occur when people are not as functional and or maybe super functional. Either way, it's basically knowing more about how it is we are what we are.
Okay, now this all starts with some very basic neural connections, and you use the word neurospecificity. Now, using that word, we're saying that there's connections and there's certain neurons that are responsible for certain reactions in the mind, which affect the body, the emotions, our behavior, etc. Where does it start? What do we first look at? What's the first indicator that this is going on within us as we respond to our life?
Well, that's a great question. And in the 1940s and 50s, there was a revolution in neurobiology when people decided that the organism and the brain in particular is built in a specific way, that under genetic control, there is a a building of the brain where nerves go to specific points, and those specific points result in particular circuits that do particular things. And prior to that, there was kind of the view that it was just all a bunch of mush, and that the brain was shaped up by the, just totally by the experience of the organism interacting with the environment. And actually, the work of my mentor, Roger Sperry, came along and says, no, that's just not the way it works. It's, the brain gets built just like anything else, and there's certain there's a certain structure that we come with. And now the question is, when we come with that structure, is there anything that comes with it? Is there kind of software, as it were, in the hardware? In other words, are there things that we're predisposed to? Are there behaviors that we have that are come with all of us humans? And the answer to that is sure, there sure are. And what science and neuroscience and developmental science and all kinds of sciences have been contributing to in the last 60 years is how that all works. And so we now have a very strong view that we have a structured brain. It comes with a lot of information, and it's also ready to learn a lot of information from the environment.
Okay, let me put that another way, because it's the tagline of the book, Free Will and the Science of the Brain. And we think we have free will, but for most of the time, we don't. We're responding to something else, some other kind of stimulus out there. The very best example of that is watch a movie. You know, you've got trained actors and actresses, and they're trained that what they say and how they say it and what they do is going to get an intentionally predetermined reaction. They're reading from a script. We know it's not real, but they're deliberately activating every emotion possible in you. You're crying, you're in love, you're frightened, you're angry, because in that moment, you're living the story. You recognize, important word, you recognize something that caused you to react, something familiar. They set up a predetermined reaction. Could have been a relationship, somebody died, something happened to a pet. Now, what causes this, we all have very specialized brain cells, those mirror neurons in the emotional part of our brain, which is just part of the internal communication structure. The key is this, is what they do is they fire up when we see or we hear something that we recognize. Then you emotionally mirror, you imitate that action in your mind. If you don't recognize it, you're not going to react to it. You've got to have an image for it. And if we're listening to things, if we're watching things, and we are responding and we are mirroring, imitating what's going on out there, we're not in charge. But if we have an idea that this exists, quote unquote, you can be in charge.
Well, you outlined one of the major theories as to what one understands what another human is doing and how they feel, is that we do mirror their emotional state in our own brain, and that's how we discover how they feel. That's a theory, by the way. That is not a demonstrated fact yet. There's evidence for it, and there's also evidence against it. But excuse me?
Oh, I'm saying you're dealing with, you know, also somatic markers, you know, and who is it?
There's all kinds of factors here.
Oh, Damasio.
Determinism.
I'm sorry, I just remembered it was Damasio. Yeah.
Yeah. Antonio Damasio. Yeah. So what this book tries to come to grips with is the fact that there is a view that since we all believe in a determinism of some kind in science. And we do think the brain enables the mind and all that. The question is, are things so determined by the physical laws and biochemical laws and physiochemical laws of the world that sort of special you that you feel you are is just kind of along for the ride, that it's all getting done by the brain? And that's been a concern of lots of people. And with that was the belief that therefore people are not to be held responsible for their action. And I think this is the key point. My book argues that, and I'm a neuroscientist, and I'm part of the club that's trying to understand more and more how we work the way we do, but I do not think that interferes or impinges on our belief that people are to be held responsible for their actions, because my argument is that while we may determine and learn and finally understand completely that brains work sort of in an automatic way, just like your liver cell, just like your kidney cell, that's not where you look for a responsibility in brains. Where you look for a responsibility is that when we join a social group, we decide as a group what the rules are going to be for the social network to work. And so the responsibility is to the network. It's the ability to follow a rule within a social group. And therefore, and this is, I'll wind this thing up, therefore, it is, no matter how much we learn about the brain, it's never going to impact that reality. That brain, how I like to put it is, brains are automatic, but people are free, because people interact, set up rules, and that's how they're to be held accountable.
Well, let me tell you what I've learned to
do. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely it does, yes. And the accountability, I think that's really where the question lies of, you know, who's accountable? I walk into a room and people look at me like I'm strange, right? And I start to get this feeling and I feel very insecure, okay. But what if I thought of a sweet little puppy and I got a smile on my face and all of a sudden I get a little bit of a shot of a dopamine, now I feel better, and what they think or feel has no effect on me anymore. And I think if we learn the basics, like you're teaching here, I think this is brilliant. I've got the book in front of me. But if we get down to the basics, we can take charge of our own world and we can be accountable for all of our behaviors and our emotions and all of our reactions. Free will and the science of the brain. When you say, who's in charge? Well, there's a way for you to be in charge, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, in the following sense is how I mean it, that that while I'm part of the juggernaut of scientists that's trying to show how the underlying mechanisms work, and with that comes an implied determinism. But how this organism works, we have, we can be in charge in the sense that by forming beliefs about the nature of the world, those beliefs can interact with the very neuronal system that is enabling us to have those beliefs. There's a vertical interaction, as it were, between the brain tissue that generates all of our cognitive life and the cognitive life itself. So the more one explores, the more one develops beliefs, the more one processes information about the environment and says, okay, this must be the way things work. Those in turn have an impact on what you do next, and therefore help control how your life actually is lived.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it also stimulates that feeling of what works and what doesn't work. I'm not getting political, just as an example. Barack Obama can get on television and somebody who doesn't like him is going to have a response. There's going to be a chemical reaction because he's going to be representative of everything they don't like. Barack Obama gets on TV and he says something that the people that follow him love. They get a good feeling, they release a certain chemical, and they walk away feeling good about what it is. And I really believe that is used against populations when those people who are running the show, it doesn't have to be here, know how to work with brain sciences, know how to stimulate the chemicals that are going to cause the behavior that they want, whether it be fear, whether it be hope, whether it be bravery, whatever it is, to cause them to move in the direction that they will. And I really believe that the work that you're doing is at base what causes, what causes the majority of the problems that we have on this planet, and what you've got is a way to fix it.
Well, I hope so. I hope I can contribute to the problem, but certainly great oratory is based on manipulating the feelings of the audience, right?
Sure,
and
yes.
These people are professional at it, and they're good at it, and any good lecturer tries to do the same thing, and any good conversationalist tries to do the same thing. So and movies do this. They splice in, you know, the filmmakers splice in particular scenes and change the duration of something, put in an innocent scene, all to manipulate the mood of the listener so they feel a particular way about the story, right?
Well, yeah, but
these are all well-known techniques in storytelling, and I guess, you know, one of the things that the neuroscientist is trying to do is just understand how a lot of phenomena that we know to be true, how they actually work. It's one thing just to describe them. It's another thing to understand how they work.
No, absolutely. But the understanding of how they work and the end result, if you had a population who understood it, it would eliminate a tremendous amount of the manipulation that goes on.
Well, listen, the greater the understanding by people of how things work and what we know about the human mind and is going to do nothing but to create greater understanding for everybody.
No, absolutely no question. Okay, let's say this. I pick up the book, I read it page by page, cover to cover, okay? And I finish the book. What do I, Michael Ray, the reader, what do I get from it that he did not have before I read it?
I think you get a sense that we should sort of move on from the age-old debates that were based at a, and generated at a time when there was no intricate knowledge about how things work in the brain and ultimately are expressed in cognition and behavior, that we're coming to understand that, and instead of being fearful of it, say, oh, isn't that wonderful? That's how things work. And taking that away, then say, okay, now we have to decide some more things, like how do we want our culture and our social life to deal with certain problems that come up when our species is engaged in, you know, wrong behavior. That's the question, and not to keep arguing whether we're responsible for it. And I say, of course you're responsible. You are the agent of the event. Now let's decide and think carefully what we want to do with you about it. And I think that's what I want to do, is kind of move the argument on to that point.
Okay, but can it be this simple? You're married, you walk into the room, and you say to your wife, nice outfit. And she says, well, so what? But you say, nice outfit, and you look good in it. Now, you've stimulated a chemical response in her brain. If you know what you're doing and you create the nice emotional response, then you're in charge. You're in charge. And they are, too, if they know exactly what you mean by what you say and what you're doing. And I think it can be brought down to that simple, as opposed to nation against nation.
I got you. I got you.
Yeah.
That's okay, always good advice to tell your wife she looks good in her dress, though.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, don't leave home without it. Okay, Michael, let me ask you this. We're running out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at?
At the University of California, Santa Barbara, it's easy to find me there.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for your time tonight. I've appreciated it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore.
That's all. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close.
Dr. Shelley Hipsky with us is an in-demand public speaker and an associate professor at Robert Morris University. She's the author of 5 books, including the internationally acclaimed Ordinary People, Extraordinary Planet. Her personal mission, and listen to it, is to educate, to entertain, and inspire people all over the world. Shelley, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about ordinary people, is there such thing as an ordinary person?
Well, I think it includes everyone. When you look at the ordinary person, that's the person down the street, or it's the Grammy Award-winning artist. It's everybody in their own way is ordinary, but then everybody has something extraordinary to give to this world.
Absolutely. If they'll allow themselves to give it. Let's take you back to when this first started for you. What was the trigger? What was that point where you said, oh, there's something special here?
That's a great question, Michael. It actually began when I was working on my 4th book. This is my 5th book. I was working with a doctoral student of mine, Claudia Bavaro. We were marketing my book. It was Mentoring Magic, Pick the Cards for Your Success. I mentored her through the whole book writing process. And we were going on radio shows like yours. And we went on one. It was Ray Leonard's show by the same name, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Planet. And he's in about 75 countries they listen to him in. And we had to retape the show. And when we had to retape the show, right before we did that, he got me in contact with a woman named Chlorel Radicilla and thought that maybe she could help me with getting spreading the word about the book. And when I talked to Chlorel on the phone, she was telling me about this Mind Your Business website that she had, and then she started to tell me her personal story and the obstacles that she had overcome. This is a woman who was getting her doctorate in education, so I kind of had a vibe with her about that. She was a single mother of three kids, and she was sitting there watching American Idol, like some of us do, and she had something go wrong with her brain, and a part of her body went into a paralysis type of mode, and it turned out that she had had a brain aneurysm. And as she was telling me this story, Michael, I got, like, so emotional. Like, tears were coming down my face. And I took the cell phone, and I just put it down on my desk. And I said, hold on. And I put the phone on speaker. I grabbed my computer, and I just started typing like a mad woman. Like, tears are going down my face. I'm listening to the story. And I was like, these stories need to be told, particularly when she said there were other stories like hers. So we went on Ray's show to tape again. And before he did, because he interviews all these inspirational people, before he hit that button that gets us on air, I said, has anybody written a book about this? Has anybody told the stories of all these different people? And he said, no. And I said, when you do, I want to be the author. And then he went on television a few days later and said, Dr. Shelley Hitzke is writing the book, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Planet. And that's when the journey really began for me with this book.
Well, and you know, if we go all over the world with it, one of the people that you do talk about, you've written about, the quadriplegic who feeds 3,000 hungry children a day. A quadriplegic is a person from the chest down who's lost it. They have no control over it. They're absolutely numb. And for most people, if that happened to them, life would be over. But not this person.
Absolutely. Mary Kay Hoodhood is absolutely honored by the President of the United States. She's been on Lifetime because of her achievements. I mean, she's just incredible. And when I got to go and interview her one-on-one in person on the camera and for the book, I was blown away because she has taken this obstacle in her life. She was in a car accident, and, you know, she can't move her arms and her legs, like you said. But beyond that, she went over that hurdle. And then she went on to organize over 150 volunteers to feed children every day. And that's in the Grand Rapids School District, where they used to have a booming economy because of the car industry, and now they don't. And then there were kids that were not being fed. She actually got so excited about it and so worked up about it because her friend who was a principal saw kids digging through the trash trying to find their dinner. So that's when she got on board and said, you know, I'm going to use my skill set that I have. And if a person and she even says it, she's like, if I'm wheelchair bound and I can do this, then other people can do this. They can find their skill set and go for it, make something happen for the world.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with this, it's that want, it's that desire. And I know this is going to be a silly question, but let's answer it. Let's bring it to the table. Do you have to be at the bottom? Do you have to have some kind of a challenge? Do you have to be crippled mentally, emotionally, physically, whatever the case may be, to get that urge to become, to help people? It seems as though that people who haven't had challenges should still get the same spark and go on to do these things.
Absolutely. I think that everybody has something deep inside of them that they can give to others around them. So I don't think you have to. Of course not. I mean, how much easier is it if you don't have those obstacles to conquer? But you know what, Michael? I really believe that most people have gone through something in their life. When you kind of dig under the surface, I mean, you're an interviewer. You know that. You kind of dig through and see what's really going on inside. And most people in their lifetime at some point, they've either been hurt or knocked down or told they couldn't do it. And why not use that as an impetus to make something happen?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. I've always felt I won't say always, the majority of my life as an adult, that when you get hit hard with something, if something just peels away, you know, if you were a turtle, peel away the shell, get you, you know, quote unquote, naked and vulnerable, that's the learning time. That's where the real power is that you can create from that, and instead of expanding on the old stuff that kept you in trouble for the first place. So, yeah, if we would just take a look at these challenges to say, ah, what's in there for me, and what can I do? Because when you do it for you, and if you do it the right way, everybody else somehow benefits from that.
Absolutely. And one of the perfect examples from the book is Chapter 1, Roy Rogers Jr. I mean, he has literally been on a tour around the country. He calls it his Homeless by Choice tour. And he's doing that because when he was 14 years old, he was homeless with his little baby brother Ray in his arms, 2 years old, and now his sister Danielle, who was 6 years old, and he had to figure out how he was going to feed his siblings, how he was going to take care of them, how he was going to get them shelter. And now he goes erect. Now he's college educated. He's, you know, standing on his own 2 feet. But what an obstacle to get over. And this is a guy that could have said, oh, you know, society gave up on me, I'm going to give up on them. But instead, he's going out there and contributing to society.
Yeah. You know, the other area to consider, too, and I know this is part of your talking points, which I think is really a question that gets answered, that can answer whatever it is to answer the question that people out there have, and they run into this all the time. They want to give back to their community, and they're afraid to do it because they don't have the money to do it. You don't have to have money to do that, do you?
No, you don't. No, I think that giving your time and your energy can be so much more beneficial at times than the money. I mean, yes, the money can pay the bills. They can do the functional things. But yet, okay, for instance, last week, my daughter and I have a four-year-old daughter, and she and I went into the homeless shelter. It's called Healthy Start, and it's all kids under six that are there with their mothers, predominantly single mothers that have been in domestic abuse relationships. We went there. They fed us a wonderful dinner. The ladies there cooked for us. And then we gave them these whoopee blankets, these security blankets that they could kind of hold on to, the kiddos could. And I read them a story. I did storytelling because that's what I do. I love to tell a good story. And the emotion that came from those women and just the appreciation that came from them, because, I mean, who you know, not everybody's doing that. Not everybody's stepping out of their comfort zone and saying, oh, you know, I could go in and I could use my skills. Maybe you're a good cook. Maybe you're good at organizing things. But if you use those skill sets and think about who you could reach out to, and quite frankly, Michael, if people just smiled at each other a little more, that would be beneficial, and that costs nothing.
It's better to... And I think everybody that's listening should try this because it works all the time for me when I do this. I walk into the market. If there's somebody on the outside that is pushing a basket out and they may happen to be older, I'll grab the basket and I'll smile at them and I'll take it from there. If somebody can't reach something, just walk over, do something. Just that one step, if that's all you do all week long, there's so many people who do not feel appreciated, do not feel that they even have an identity and they're not recognized. And what we need to do is just smile and say hello. That in and of itself can probably, Shelley, save a life someday.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so many people that, you know, like we were saying, that there's people that have obstacles in their life, but so many people are so guarded about themselves. They don't want people to see that they're hurting inside. And maybe just that, you know, how you doing? Can I help you with something? Maybe that'll get them over that hump and get them to the next day. And then possibly they'll be able to help someone themselves. So you never really know what you're passing on to someone.
No, and you know, it's called that old pay it forward, because if you do it and if you do it without even thinking about doing it, if it just becomes an automatic something and somebody else does it and somebody else does it, and pretty soon you've got a lot of people doing it, they have no idea where it came from, but who cares as long as it gets done? I think it's the one big problem we have, especially in this country today. Nobody touches anybody anymore. It's all texting and the rest of it. And a smile
absolutely
can go. Yeah.
You know, when I think about that, I used to be an assistant principal at a school for emotionally and behaviorally challenged kids. So we had like 200 kids there, kindergarten to 12th grade. All of them had been through these like horrific experiences. I mean, I had this one kid who he had walked the streets with his mother who was a prostitute in Chicago. I had other kids that had been in just horrible abusive situations. So these were kids that were just walking around with the burden of the world on them. And there was one day I remember I had just had it with people not being able to reach out and give a hug, because these are kids that are not typically hugged. They don't know. So what I did was I got on the PA, and I know that some people are listening to this and going, whoa, you can't do this in school. But I was the assistant principal, and I got on the PA, and I said, hello, everybody. It is National Hug Your Neighbor Day. And everybody was going around doing this happy hug day, and the smiles on the kids' faces, the smiles on the staff's faces, they were elated. Like, they just got into the moment. They were giving each other hugs. They were smiling at each other. And sometimes you just need that. You just need the human smile and touch and just to be happy and form friendships and bonds with people.
And how long did it take for the SWAT team? How long did it take for the SWAT team to show up?
It really didn't. It really didn't. It was a very positive day. I'm probably going to get some calls about that one.
Shelley,
everybody got into the moment, and it was a happy thing.
Oh, and that's great. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at.
Absolutely. That would be www.shelleyhipsky.com. SHELLIEHIPSKY. So it's like hip sky phonetically.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated it. And go get them.
Thank you. You take care, Michael. It was wonderful, and I'd love to do it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely, Shelley. Good night.
Love that lasts forever. Take care. Bye-bye.
I promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love that I can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Craig Greenlee's with us. He's a veteran sports journalist, a Marshall University graduate. He served as sports editor at Upscale Magazine and is a former correspondent for Black Issues and Higher Education. And he is the author of the book November Ever After, a memoir of tragedy and triumph in the wake of the 1970 Marshall football plane crash. Hey, Craig, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you doing this evening? And pleased to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much. You know, when we look back at, I remember it in 1970, and you know, and even to this day, it had an effect. Those weren't just people killed in that crash, the football plane crash. There was a whole mindset. There was an emotion that was also part and parcel of that school. When you take a look back and you see it the way for what it was, what's your reaction to that?
Well, certainly it's an event that you will never forget because it's so much a part of you. Of course, you're talking about college-age kids. I was 20 sure. years old at the time. And, you know, we're at that point in our lives where we're beginning to discover who we are and the type of things that we want to pursue, you know, as adults, profession-wise and that type of thing. And, of course, you're developing friendships that, for the most part, you know, tend to last a lifetime, of course. In this instance, there were a lot of people who passed away, you know, on that plane. Sure. Of course, we never got to that point. But I think what's significant about that period of time is that Marshall was beginning to show signs of turning the corner in his football program. Marshall wasn't very good up until that point. And a whole team is just wiped out in a very horrible fashion. And not only just the football team, but you're talking about athletic administrators, school administrators, very prominent people in the community, doctors, attorneys, business people, civic leaders. So there was a huge loss that touched everyone, regardless of what your economic status was, sure. you know, whether you attended school at Marshall or not, just to be in the city. It was very difficult for you not to be impacted by that heavy gravity of grief that just engulfed the city during that time.
Well, sure. And what it hit, very important, what it hit was football is a culture. And all those people in and involved of it, it destroyed the base of the culture. It had to be rebuilt again. Look at the stuff at Penn State. You know, what's going on right now with, you know, with the problems that they have. But what they did was they said, let's forget about this because it's football, it's school, it's culture. That's not right or wrong. But when you go back to something as horrific as the plane crash, it was more than just people dying. It had an emotional impact. It also had the historic and the cultural impact that it left behind. My goodness, what a terrible thing to happen. And look at the people who got left with the holes in their hearts, and that fullness that they had with those people that were killed was gone.
Well, you've touched on some very important points, which is really one of the reasons that I was compelled to write the book. In previously produced media presentations, of course, there's the movie We Are Marshall, and then there's also, I think, three documentaries that deal with the tragedy. But you don't hear a lot of different voices of the folks who were left behind, you know, the folks who had to really deal with this thing, not only in the months, you know, that followed the tragedy, but also years down the road. I interviewed maybe 20 people for the book, a lot of whom were there at the time that I was. So we're talking about recollections that are very personal, that are very deep, that people had never gotten the opportunity to express themselves before. So it's a very up-close and personal look at a horrific event and how people were able to somehow, you know, pull themselves through it, while at the same time watching a program literally resurrect itself. So when you look at that, you're talking about the very worst of it when you're talking about an entire team being decimated. But at the same time, you begin to see signs, even as early as 1971, the year after the crash, that this program was going to be on its way back. Of course, it took a while, but eventually Marshall, 20, 30 years down the road, became one of the winningest programs in the country. In fact, in the 90s, Marshall University had the winningest, had won more football games than any university in the country, and that includes all the big guys.
You know, by the way, one of the people that didn't get on that trip, the fatal trip, the Ed Carter, started an evangelical ministry, and that, I'm sure, he got the word loud and clear that he was spared for something, and he's created this ministry all over the world.
Well, yes, Ed and I have known each other for quite some time. In fact, he came in the year after I did. I came to Marshall initially in 1968 as part of a huge recruiting overhaul. Well, I should say a huge overhaul in terms of just revamping the football program. And Ed was part of that, but he came in the second year. And his mom actually had told him about what was going to happen something like 10, 12 days before the crash. He, his dad had passed away, and his mom had called him to tell him to come home for the funeral. And during the course of the conversation, she mentioned that she did not want him going on the plane. Now, Ed was very surprised at this because back then, Marshall very seldom flew. In most cases, road trips were basically bus trips. So he was surprised to know, well, how did my mother know that we were even flying? That was the first time he knew anything about it. And then on top of it, when she told him, well, I don't want you going because there will be a plane crash and there will be no survivors. Well, of course, he did not believe her, and he wouldn't dare tell anybody about that afterwards. Of course, when he went home and he was there and got word of the crash, and of course it just really, I guess, was a huge wake up call for him. And basically, Ed there in Texas got a Sunday paper and virtually read his obituary in the newspaper because everyone thought that he was on the plane, obviously, because he was a starting offensive lineman. So that in itself, I guess, would send a very heavy signal. Well, you're here because of a reason that goes beyond just football. So sure. When Ed graduates, he, I guess maybe it might have been a year or so after that he was led to go into the ministry. And this ministry is based on the fact that he was not on the plane. That's been the message that has gotten him all over the globe. And he's still going strong here 30-some-odd years later. I think the ministry now is in its 36th or even 37th year. So the fact that not only that, but he's preached in places where most black ministers had not been invited previously, before, I guess, maybe late 70s, early 80s, which was in itself groundbreaking. And then in addition to that, there was at least two instances that I know of where former teammates would hear Ed preach, and they would give their lives to Christ. So you have a ministry that was birthed from tragedy that's doing some very wonderful things, and these things continue to happen years after 1970.
Now, what about the other Carter, Dickie?
Dickie's situation is a little bit different. Dickie was a star running back for 3 years. In fact, that was his senior year. And he and Coach Tolley, who was the head coach, didn't see eye to eye on some things, Dickie wound up leaving the team several weeks before the crash. And the thing about Dickie that's always amazed me is that in most, I've seen most of the media projects devoted to the tragedy, and you never see anything about him. It's like he's persona non grata. And I always thought that was strange because he was a star running back, for one thing. And he'd been there for 3 years, and certainly, you know, he left his mark, you know, on the program while he was there. And to just, you know, sort of just X him out as if he just never existed, I thought was just not right, simply because they were his teammates also. The interesting thing about Dickie is that on the night of the crash, he was at some friend's house off campus, and he was riding back through town after he got the word that there had been a plane crash and it was Marshall's team and everything. And then he just driving back through town, going back to campus, he encounters one of the other players who did not make the trip because he was injured. Well, of course, they went out to the airport. They were actually there at ground zero maybe, I don't know, 30 minutes or so after the plane had actually crashed. And so they was, you know, he describes the scene about how it was so numbing and shocking. It's cold, it's muddy, it's wet, it's foggy, it's you know, drizzling and everything. And people are just, you know, literally just frozen in shock and dismay because they're sitting there, standing there, watching this mountainside burn with all this wreckage strewn all over the place, maybe about a quarter of a mile in a radius or so. So, you know, and Dickie tells me about he's had numerous visions where he was not able to sleep very well, and this happened for several years, and he describes it in the book as how he can envision him actually being with the team and practicing and actually playing a game and then flying back. And then once the plane crashes, then he's outside of the plane looking at all this scene with everything smoldering wreckage and brush fires and all this kind of thing. So you can imagine what that has been like for him. And his story has never been told until now.
Craig, there was something else going on that most people don't even know about. The plane crash more than likely averted what could have been a full-scale race riot on the campus.
Well, that's a scenario. I'm not sure why that's always been kind of skipped over, but, you know, and I guess perhaps depending on what side of the fence you're on in terms of whether you were mainstream or whether you were a black student, from a black student's perspective, it's very difficult to talk about November 14th and not talk about what happened on November 13th, which was the day before. Which also just happened to be a good Friday the 13th, mm-hmm. And what happened was there was an intramural football game between one of the all-white fraternities and the black student organization, and it was a very intense game. It was playoffs, I think maybe the semifinals or something like that. So you know everybody was revved up for the game and that type of thing. But anyway, what happened was the fraternity had this reputation for. They always carried around this rebel flag. We call it the Stars and Bars, or it's the Confederate flag. And it irritated a lot of black folks because, you know, we found it to be offensive. And we felt like, well, look, if that's the what you believe, then fine, but you shouldn't be able to bring that to university functions. Well, you know, petitioned the university and never got anything done about it. As the game wore on, hostilities just kind of got, you know, just kind of just escalated. And sure. Then after the game, which the black kids lost, and of course, you know, that's one point there. But what really tipped it off was that the fraternity and a lot of the black students who were in the stands watching the game were kind of joined back and forth all game long, trading insults. I'm not sure exactly what was said because I was coaching the Black United Students team, so I wasn't really aware of what was being said. But I do know that they were going back and forth all game long. So after the game was over, we were walking back towards the cafeteria, and then I looked around, and then there were like these three guys, and I guess they must have been pledges. They were running all through this crowd of black kids waving a Confederate flag. And I thought right then, what are they doing? I said, they can't be serious. I said, boy, they're taking their lives in their hands. And that's when folks just started fighting. I mean, it was awful. It was so bad until the city police had to be called in. Not the campus police, but the city sure. police. So, you know, things were so bad that night, I felt within myself that, hey, I'm not sure what's going to happen here. We were telling everybody, look, if you're going somewhere tonight, make sure you're in a group. Don't be by yourself or with either just one or two people. Make sure you're in a group because you need to do that to ensure safety because we really didn't know because things were just that tense. And so you go from that scenario on a Friday afternoon, early Friday evening, and you fast forward 24 hours later, and because of the crash and the suddenness of it, and just the sheer shock and just the sheer, just the that whole scale bereavement and just, you know, just unbelief that it's like the fights from the day before never happened. And the reason why is because it cuts so deep across everybody's psyche. Whether you played football or like myself, I played with most of those guys who were on that plane. And, you know, most people knew most of the players because it was a fairly close-knit campus. There were no such things as athletic dorms the way we know it today, meaning that the athletes weren't segregated like they are in most places now. And you go to a dorm and you're subject to see football and basketball players and regular students all on the same floor. So in a situation like that, folks really get a chance to kind of mingle and you know each other and things like sure. that in a way that you probably don't have on most college campuses today. So that's another reason I think that it cuts so deep, because it's not only like, well, this guy played football, but it was somebody that they may have studied with, somebody that was maybe down the hall that they'd have a lot of different conversations with, where it becomes more personal. You know, and I think that's a factor that you can never really you can't emphasize that enough, because, you know, somebody knew somebody. You knew this guy. You saw him one day, and the next day they were gone. And that's just something that is just very hard you know it in your mind. You know it logically, but psychologically, it's a little bit different story.
You know, it's interesting, Craig. We're starting to run out of time, but for whatever, in the grand scheme of things, had that plane not crashed, you wouldn't have had Ed Carter doing what he's done, touching lives all over the world. Who knows what would have happened the next day, and how many lives might have been taken then, or not, or lives being changed. So one never knows, and it happened, and we're also sorry that it happened. Obviously, we'll never feel what those people feel that was their family and their loved ones and the friends, you know, that actually died there. But sometimes I really believe there is a grand scheme to things, and there's a reason for everything. And with that, Craig Greenlee, is there a website we can find you at?
NovemberEverAfter.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Craig, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, I thank you, and you have a good evening.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Cheers.